Hi, this is Stan Collymore.
And you are listening to the V2 Football Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I'm Chris Lappin. I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Paul Parker. How are you doing this morning, Paul?
It's not too bad at all.
Yeah, so how are you enjoying it out in Asia?
I have been out here a long time now.
Yeah.
Just kind of jumped on a plane. I'm 2.5 hours away from where I actually live in Asia, which is Singapore. I'm actually in Bali at the moment in time.
Yeah.
I need to go back to
Bali. So for those who don't know, Paul is a defender who used to play for Man United, QPR, Fulham, England, and is currently, as he said, coaching out in Singapore. So as we ask all our guests, how were you spotted?
I was spotted for Fulham. I was playing for a football team in Dagenham.
Yeah.
I went there when I was about 10 years of age. And Fulham at the time just had a local scout who lived in the Barking area. And the actual team I was playing for had two or three players. One of the players who was with me at Fulham, Quest Park Rangers, was a lad called Dean Coney.
Yeah.
There was about three or four of us who actually used to go there because, strangely enough, Fulham had a training camp in Dagenham, in Stevenage, and one in Slough as well. So it's just strange that, you know, being in a big West Ham area, that Fulham had a place just there in Dagenham.
Yeah.
All places. Dagenham, which is predominantly a West Ham place. And that's where I got found playing football in the league for a team that played out of Dagenham. And they had a training camp, which is, a mile and a half away from my home in Raynham.
So do you remember making your first team debut?
My first team debut, I come in as sub against Reading.
Yeah.
I remember it was a home game against Reading at the back end of the 80s, the back end of the, I made my debut when I was 17, so it'd have been 1981, that was, coming as sub. It was against Reading, and I actually come on and I had to do a man-to-man job on Kerry Dixon.
Wow. When he was playing. So we've had a listener's question, and it's a bit of a, it's not a serious one, but it's a, Michael Jackson's a huge Fulham fan. Did you ever see him there in the 80s?
Not a Fulham, no. I can remember that with that silly statue went up, which was, well, I think everyone found it, but anyone in the football fraternity would have found that totally embarrassing, and I'm sure a lot of Fulham fans did find it totally embarrassing. It didn't make any difference. If your owner knew Jesus, you wouldn't expect him to put a statue up of Jesus, would you?
No, I think it's in the football museum in Preston, though. I think that's got statues. Alright, so you also played for QPR. How did you find playing as a young black player in the 80s?
Very, very tough.
Yeah.
I personally think it made me more than anything. It made me as a person, made me what I am today. I was deemed as second generation.
Yeah.
The people I looked up to as playing then was the likes of Laurie Cunningham, Brendan Batson, Cyril Regis, Viv Anderson. They was all playing, and it was very tough, especially that I was at Fulham in the early 80s and I was playing in the old third division. So going into Yorkshire was always very nasty.
Yeah.
Anywhere down south was fine because there was a lot of black players around. Yes, there were still ignorant people around, but nowhere near as bad it was going when you play games up north and you go into on the east side of the country, you know, to Leeds, to Rotherham, to Barnsley, to Huddersfield, to Newcastle, to Hull. It was bad. It was just something which you had to get on to. You had to get on with if you was a footballer. You had to accept it. There was no going to the manager and questioning it and saying what's going on or showing any real emotions, because if you were showing the manager that you was like it was bothering you, if you were scared of it and you didn't like it, then the manager would turn around and just give you, you know, two choices, deal with it or get out.
Yeah.
It wasn't kind of, you know, managers going to back you up or quote anywhere, because everyone was all they was concerned about was their jobs and winning games of football. being a young black player, he didn't care. As long as I was winning games, they didn't care that I was finding it tough or if I was getting emotional. They wouldn't have worried about it. It wasn't about because they were racist or anything. It was the fact of, it was just a case of get on with it or get out. That's how it was.
So you did find that playing in London was better when it came to, is it better when it came to the abuse? Maybe at London derbies it was better? Or?
No, London derbies, there was no great issue. No. Obviously, even then in the 80s, was multicultural. It was multicultural in the sense of it was like white, black and Indians, really. there was a lot of Polish about and whatever, but London was completely different. It was just a case of when you went out of London, it was, I was going to use the word, really bad. It was nasty. Mm. What was said when I was going to pick up a football for a throw-in, and there was people on the side of the stand, on the side of the pitch, and what they used to say to you, even with young kids there, it was something that you just couldn't believe that a man would say in front of his own child, and then when you question it, they would virtually turn around and tell you that child was just going to hate you, you as well, he's going to grow up and he's going to be a racist. That was a whole thing. That's what it was all about, to say that they didn't care, but they had the young child, and that child deserved the opportunity to make his own mind up about life and how he intended to fulfill his place in life. The virtue said, my child's going to grow up a racist and look like anybody who didn't have white skin. If the kid, the person hasn't got white skin, my child's not going to like him. And it was disgraceful, but it was something that, made me stronger, and it helped me get, what I did, and even now, and you see how things are now, my kids now, and life's better, life's easier for them. And what it was, being a young black person in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and not just in football, but in life in general, it's all changed.
Yeah, I just want to quickly mention the World Cup Italia 90, because the semi-final against Germany is my first clear football memory. It must have been heartbreaking at the time, but looking back in hindsight, was it one of your proudest moments as a player, reaching the semi-final?
Yeah, that definitely is in there, and a little clutch of things that have happened throughout my career, that would definitely be in there. What happened, it was something that really happened out of the blue more than anything, because actually going, it was, maybe I shouldn't have really been going, because at the time I was suspended at a club football. I'd been sent off at the back end of the season.
Yeah.
About 18th season I got sent off, so I was under suspension. There was a few of the G&T brigade, the Blazer gang, who thought it was disgraceful that they was taking me out there. But when I was suspended from club football, all those know-it-alls turn up for the free booze. We didn't have a clue who you were. Those idiots. And I just assumed, because leading up to the World Cup, I'd actually gone. I had not played in any competitive games for England. I'd made a full debut. I'd come in. I had 15 minutes of competitive football in an England shirt under my belt, which was coming on a sub against Albania at Wembley.
Yeah.
In 1989, I think it was April 1989, I come on a sub against Albania. We won 5-0. That was my only competitive appearance as a sub. So I went to the World Cup with nothing there at all. We ended up playing 6 out of 7 games. It certainly propelled me forward as a person, in the sense that all of a sudden people might have known my name in football, but people knew my face after that.
Yeah.
One of the great things for me as well is that I've done it as a Queen's Park Rangers player. When I hear people screaming and shouting now that they're not getting picked because they deem themselves at a small club, I don't fall into that. At the end of the day, as far as I'm concerned, if you're good enough, you get picked. Or I was very, very lucky that the manager of England at the time, Bobby Robson, was never going to fall into that because, as far as Bobby Robson had managed Fulham, played for Fulham, managed Fulham, and managed Ipswich Town.
Yeah.
And he was a little bit more, he was more concerned about the player, not about the club they played for. And if people were to actually look at that team, or those players in that squad, you would have seen that, yes, there was Brian Robson, Manchester United, there was Peter Beardsley, Steve McMahon, John Barnes, Liverpool. But then I think if you look at the rest of it, in that back, in There was Trevor Stephen, who was Everton. Oh, no, he was Rangers. Terry Butcher was Rangers. Chris Woods was Rangers. Paul Gascoigne was Spurs. Gary Lineker was, I think he was Spurs then. Yeah. Well, certainly when we came, he was Spurs. But it wasn't, you know, all these big five clubs or anything. It was players from all over the place. I haven't even gone into the players who were, you know, Steve Hodge, I think, was Leeds United, if I remember rightly. Neil Webb might have been Forest, but or Manchester, they might have just gone to United. But it wasn't all big clubs. Players from all different clubs. So I think it just made such a difference from where players come from. And for me personally, going out, you know, I was number 12 was my number, my squad number.
Yeah.
And that's what I wore that most of the time, going in, always had number 12. I had so many number 12 shirts where I just sat on the bench and never ever got on Bobby Robson. There was more chance of Bobby Robson, as far as he's concerned, he owned those caps, he made them himself. He spent all the money doing it because he wouldn't give them away.
No.
He would not give it to anybody. You had to earn the right. You had to earn the right. You couldn't just suddenly turn up in the squad and suddenly get on the pitch. That wasn't in his remit at all. It was about you sit and watch in the stand for a while, then you can sit on the bench, and if you're lucky, you get on. But he was very loyal to his players. And that squad, those players who played in, those players who actually got England to the World Cup in 1990. I think those players, they almost played, a lot of them played almost every single game in that qualifying. It's only when he got to the final where he done major surgery on the team, because he suddenly realised, I think through the help of a few senior players, that he had to do something, that he had to change it. He needed to change a different style to make sure that we actually got through the group stage and we could compete against, you know, the sides in there. And doesn't matter, even the lesser sides in that World Cup, they was all very, very good technically at keeping the ball. So we set up as a team to actually help us, maybe to try to stop them outpassing us in midfield. And that's why we switched the system to a 3-5-2.
Yeah, so do you think that probably the biggest legacy of England at 1990 was it made it cool to be a football fan again after the troubles of the 80s?
It definitely, I still believe it. It might sound like a cliche, but that World Cup is the reason why the Premier League is what it is now.
Yeah.
But that World Cup gave a lot of people who wiped their hands of football, or people who didn't even watch it but suddenly just got a bad taste because it was a fad not to like football because of what went on in the 80s. So that World Cup, everyone fell back in love with football, an England football team. And that helped the Premier League to get, I think, all of a sudden, the Premier League could go forward with a sponsor. Someone was interested, i.e. Barclays, interested in football again because it gave it a good feel factor. And that's why the Premier League is what it is now, because of that World Cup, when the ordinary man in the street will tell you exactly where he was when England played Germany in that semi-final.
Yeah, so I say it's my first football memory. It might be a false memory that I've been told about so much, but I do actually remember watching it when I was about 7.
Well, I really don't want to know how old you are.
Oh, man. I'm in the 30s now. So after QPR, what prompted you move to Man United?
It just come down to the fact of Gerry Francis didn't want me there anymore. He'd come in as manager, and he was in his contract he signed, he was getting a percentage of a deal every time he sold a player on.
All right.
So as soon as he arrived, I was the first one that he wanted to go. He didn't really want me there. To be perfectly honest, I didn't really want to be there with him. I still now love Queen's Park Rangers. They're my first team I look for all the time, and I just lost that enjoyment of being there when he arrived, and the way things and how things changed dramatically when he arrived. It wasn't me. He made it obvious during the pre-season of the 1991 season. Is that right? The 1991-92 season.
Yeah.
The pre-season that he didn't want me there. The club tried to get me to move to Arsenal. I didn't end up going to Arsenal. I didn't want to go to Arsenal. And a few other clubs come in, but the only other club which I talked to prior to signing for Manchester United was Tottenham.
Yeah.
And I think I would have been on the verge of going to Tottenham, but I didn't really want to even go to Tottenham. I still had this thing about Queen's Park Rangers. But in the Terry Venables at the Royal Lancaster Hyde Park, got a phone call to go up and chat to Manchester United. And the moment I got to that ground, I never left Manchester for 3 months.
Yeah.
I just stayed down and moved into the Midland Hotel and virtually just by going out and buying clothes, I virtually just went out and just bought myself a whole new stack of clothes and everything, and never come back to Essex, where my house was, for 3 months, because, you know, I'd done pre-season, I started the season, and that's it. I went there, and, you know, as far as, you know, as it worked out, I was very, very fortunate that I played for a club that I fell in love with, Queen's Park Rangers, and I was very, very fortunate as well when going to play for Manchester United, which was a bit of a rarity, because at that given time, not many players from Londoners went to play football in the north of England.
Yeah.
They just didn't go. So it kind of caused a little bit of a storm. People were kind of shocked that I'd gone. They thought, you know, that I was going to stay in London, and to be perfectly honest, I thought I did as well. It never crossed my mind that I was ever going to go and play for Manchester United, let alone go and live in the north of England.
So did you feel something special was about to happen at United as soon as you arrived?
No, not at all. People keep saying, and I should really make up a little bit of a story of how it is, but to be perfectly honest, I just remember being as a kid, and I always felt that every summer I was sitting down after school and school holidays, and it, you know, come to the May time, I think in the spring holiday when it was, and Manchester United were always playing at Wembley on a sunny day. Tommy Docherty was always leading them out. Martin Buchan was the captain, and it got to that point of seeing them always in the final. As then, at that time, you know, it wasn't about who won the league. It was about who was playing in the cup final and who won it. That was the final talking point of football, and that was everybody wanted to play in the cup final. So for me, it was the thing about playing for Manchester United, because it was like the most glamorous club in England. Even, you know, going there as a QPR player, just felt special playing at Old Trafford. It's amazing playing at those kind of stadiums as a player that it actually lifts you, and all of a sudden you could be an average team, but you become a better team because it's just that lift of just going to that kind of stadium. And it's the same when you played at Anfield, even to the point of when you played at Arsenal, when you played at Tottenham, it's just those kind of games. But I just suddenly just went there, and yes, there was players I was playing with. I knew Brian Robson, but there was players I used to play against, and it's like this wow thing, because they were the kind of bigger names that people talked about on TV or you read about. You didn't know anything about them because there wasn't that intrusion of so much media then. But then all of a sudden, I knew Mark Hughes very well, because I was always man marking him when I played, you know, up against him all the time when I played at QPR. But other than that, really, I didn't know anyone, so he was very, very nervous. My first step into the changing room at the Cliff training ground, I was so nervous when I went in, and I ended up just sitting down, and I sat opposite Brian McClair, who's maybe one of the most driest blokes I've ever met in my life. When he talked to you, you sat down for 5 minutes, and you try to figure out if he's just taking a mickey out of you. He was so dry and so intelligent that you had to really think about it, and then you suddenly realised, no, he was okay, but it took a while to get used to, because he was just, Brian McClair was always checking you out to see if you was right for Manchester United. He had this thing about him where he knew about people, he just felt he didn't feel he knew the players who were right for the club. That's how it was, because he was the same as Sir Alex, he was Manchester United through and through, and he just wanted to, his way was sizing you up. It took a few months before he started talking to me properly, and we ended up sharing a room in the back end of my time at Old Trafford. But it was definitely nerve-wracking going there as a player, walking into a dressing room, even coming from QPR, then even still then in the same division. So players who walked in who were outside of that division as well, it must have been even worse, but it was definitely a little bit intimidating first going in there, then having, you know, first training session, and where I've gone from maybe being a big fish in a small pond, I suddenly went to this big pond, and there was big crocs all over the place, and I was just this little goldfish in there, hoping at one time I could hit the surface and make an impression.
Right, so I've got another listener's question. Chris Verrill asks, outside United fans, do you feel the partnership of Bruce and Pallister doesn't get the credit it deserves?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think we're just in that era now that people suddenly just see these people bursting in the media, make them into something that a lot of them are not, and we work off of what we see. around and they keep saying about, oh, well, he's this footballer. And I said, well, Pally was a great book, great person with the ball at his feet. Steve Bruce was as good in the air as any Manchester since his time, as good as in the air as any Manchester United player that's been since 1996. Without a doubt, Brucey was. Pally was as quick as it, maybe quicker than any other centre half they've had.
Yeah.
But it's the media coverage and it's the new age fans. It's that kind of era that they forget. But I think the heart of Manchester United fan will just remember that era, remember the first team that won the Premier League, and all of a sudden they look at it and they suddenly relate to it. And they'll tell their kids and go on, and then they'll know it. But outside of that, people just then will talk about. They'll go back maybe as far as Yapstam, Ronnie Johnson, Henningberg, and they'll talk about Rio and Rio this and Rio that, and they'll forget that, in my opinion, that Gary Pallister was a better all-round player than Rio Ferdinand, because he was just as good in the ball, and Rio Ferdinand definitely wasn't any quicker than Gary Pallister. Pally was very, very good in the air. Defensively, Pally was great. Yeah, he was crap in the opposition box. I can't remember Pally scoring with his head. Pally, there's more chance of Pally doing an overhead kick than scoring with his head in the opponent's box. But in a defending box, Pally was absolutely brilliant. Brucey, you know, for a centre-half, Brucey would be deemed quite small in today's world. But Brucey didn't lose many headers. I've never seen a man that somehow judged that he was... People looking to jump, Brucey will somehow size the situation up and all of a sudden he'll bring the ball down in his chest in and around people. Really, Brucey was very, very clever in how he played. People wouldn't have respected how good Brucey was until they actually played next to him. And you speak to any player from my era, that they would come out and, you know, they would talk about Brucey and say how good he was. Even, you know, I was with Des Walker a few months ago at an England v Germany game in Singapore and Hong Kong. You sit there and you talk to Des, and Des can talk the hind legs off of a horse. He never stops talking. But Des would just rave about Brucey. You know, players are very respectful when they think someone's good. That's the best. They'll tell you, and then you'll actually respect what they've said to you. How good they'll talk about people. Brucey was so respected in the game. That's, as a player, definitely 100%, but as a man as well. And that's why people have got so much respect for him as a manager now. There wouldn't be many people who would want to play for Steve Bruce.
Hey, do you think there'll ever be another Alex Ferguson?
Oh, of course, yeah. No, maybe not in my lifetime, but there definitely will be. People thought there would never be another Brian Clough, you know, who would go and achieve, you know, what he'd done for such a small club and things, and people believe that will happen. But it does happen. It will happen in a different way. No one's ever going to come out and say, oh, there he is, he's another Brian Clough. Someone comes out who's in those same lines, and someone will come out and be successful, be very forthright in what they do, and be like a Sir Alex Ferguson. There'll never, ever be another one, but there'll be someone who'll be like him.
Yeah.
No one's going to go up and do during their time that he's done, go and win 13 league titles. It's not going to happen for a long time in English football. I don't think the club's not going to be that superior to go and do it, to be able to go and do that, because the amount of money is just too easy to go there and compete without having to work that hard as what he had to get to where he was and what he made Manchester United. Yes, United spent money, but he didn't just suddenly just go out and buy. He mixed in or he amalgamated young up-and-coming players with experienced players as well, so those young players would improve as men, but improve as footballers as well. And managers today just haven't got that time, or a lot of them don't bother. They just go and spend, because Sir Alex, not only did he bring in young players, or did he bring in top players as well, those players improved while they was there at Manchester United as well. And that doesn't really happen today. Players, you don't see many players go and get better with clubs now. They go out and people are trying to buy the finish article, because the finish article they're hoping will go and win them something or keep them in a job, should I say.
I'd say you're currently working for JSSL in Singapore. Could you give us a quick overview of the organisation? What's your role within it?
Well, JSSL, I would say, is it's 100% the biggest soccer school in... I use that word soccer. I've been away from England for too long. It was called a soccer school. Now we're a football club, because we've gone from... When I first got involved with it in about April 2011, I got involved then as a partner, Harvey Davis, who's the managing director of the company. We had about 300-400 kids. Now we've got over 1,200 kids now in our soccer school from the age of 4 up until 16. We're about 50% expat.
Yeah.
50% Singaporean, which would be Singaporean, Malay, Chinese and Indian. We run the biggest youth league in Singapore as well. We run all the youth football leagues there. And we run the biggest tournament, I would say, in Asia as well, which is the JSSL Sevens, which has been running now since 2013. We started off with 40 teams from around Asia. Now we've got, this year, we've got 260 coming into club. From the north of Asia to the middle, coming in from Asia, the Middle East, coming in from there, coming in from Australia, and coming from down south, like Indonesia as well. We're running an academy tournament this year, Sevens Italian, a professional academy tournament, under 16s. So this year we've got Fulham's coming into it. They're bringing the team across for it. We've got Sporting Lisbon, we've got Bangkok United, we've got a team called Penang FA from Malaysia, and there's one more as well, which I have some, and Perth Glory.
Yeah.
Who are from Western Sydney, Western Australia. So this is our first time we're doing it. We're looking to grow it to 10 teams next year. So this year's just going to be a 16 tournament because we're just going to add one of our teams in there as well so they get experience. But we've decided just to add that to it because the tourist board now they've given us a grant for 3 years now. They've been watching us for a few years. They want us to grow even bigger. So we had to add that this year. We can make a mock stadium in the middle of Singapore on a big grass area called the Padang.
Yeah.
Where the Singapore Cricket Club is. We're going to make a little mock stadium there for these boys to go and play in there. All these boys are going to be boys who are under 16. They're chasing a scholarship with their professional clubs. So for them, they're coming across as well to earn the right for a contract. They're not just coming across because it's a nice trip to Singapore. This is very competitive and they get the opportunity to play against Sporting Lisbon. They get the opportunity to say to play against it's going to be a very physical team from Australia, Perth Glory. But there's going to be the technical side of a team from Bangkok, a team from Thailand, Bangkok. The Thais, Thailands are the best as a team, professional team. They're the best team in Southeast Asia. They win every competition in Southeast Asia as a nation.
Yeah.
As team, as club sides, they're very strong as well. A team called Montong, who Robbie Fowler managed for a while. They're maybe one of the strongest club sides in Southeast Asia. So now a lot of English clubs are looking at Thai players. Technically, individually, they're the best in Southeast Asia. Leicester City, obviously, are looking in there. There's a few clubs who have taken a few over. So this will grow into a very, very big tournament. Very big tournament, a big football tournament on the professional side as well. In a country which, in theory, isn't a football country, Singapore. Mm. It loves the Premier League, as most people do, but it's soccer school JSSL has grown into to be a big football body in Singapore. So I've been involved, obviously, now from 2011, and it's grown to what it is now because of just for the fact that we just two people together who just love football and just really just pushing something which isn't driven in Singapore. And it's driven by the love of it as well, by the expat community who live there. And there's obviously the local community who love it as well. So it's been taken on by all sides, and it's just growing now with good sponsorship now as well from big major companies who have got involved as well with youth football. So we're just really hoping that, you know, that this professional side goes well. We can grow it next year, and then we're hoping to make this into a proper Asian Gofia Cup.
Yeah.
That's the outcome. That's where we got it from. I went to Gofia Cup for the first time in 2012.
Yeah.
And I never knew anything about the Gofia Cup. When I got told about it, I asked where it was, and they told me Sweden. I went, no. And I suddenly went there, and when you're watching 1,500 teams from all over the world for this week, playing this week football tournament in Gothenburg, you suddenly realise that, I was monocled, I was hidden, I was cotton-walled, I didn't know about it. Then you suddenly find that Alan Shearer played in it, there's been a few big names who have played in it as well. And then that gave us a little bit of the inspiration to think, why can't we do something like this in Asia? Singapore, it's difficult to do it 11-a-side because the amount of space and just 11-a-side pitches grass are tough to find.
Yeah.
Grass is tough. Seven aside, very easy to do, you know, but a lot of it is done on 4G AstroTurf, but the main cuts of the tournament is going to be on the centre of Singapore, and it's going to be on beautiful grass at the Singapore Cricket Club.
Right, and one last one from me. So what's the plans for the future? Are you hoping to get back into management, or are you happy staying out in Asia, doing what you're doing?
No, I've got no interest. I did non-league, and yeah. I was non-league for. I still love, when I come back, I like to go and watch a few games and just chat. That's what football's about when you go to a game.
Yeah.
Yes, you'll sit on the game, but, you know, if it's 90 minutes, you might only watch 25 of it, because all you're doing is chatting, you're catching up on gossip and players and things. But I'd love to come back and watch it, be around it, but the management side of it and all that, it ruins your weekends. That's what football does. It ruins your weekends. there's no fun. You win a game.
Yeah.
You chase to go and win another game. You're chasing about players, good, bad, or indifferent. And I just enjoy now going out and doing, talking about it. You know, talking about football. I have to say, I think my objective now is to at some point try and get myself back to the UK. I think that's my objective now. Is I've been away since August 2009. I left the UK, and now I think it's family-wise, my two boys are back in education now in the UK. One in university, one in sixth form college. So I think now it's just now. I think me and my wife are both looking now to get back. You know, the boys have got a good education behind them. I've got two grandchildren who are living in Reading as well with my daughter. I think we're just looking that way now, getting ourselves back. And more than anything, I just look forward to watching football at a proper hour of the day.
Yeah.
Rather than when I'm working at 3 o'clock in the morning, doing the late game, you know, Champions League at 3 o'clock in the morning, games kicking off at 10, you know, 3 p.m. UK kicking off at 10 or 11 o'clock, depending where the clocks are all the time at night.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just all of that. Just suddenly get up and just think to myself, I want to go and watch a game of football. I'm looking forward. I want to come back. I want to do co-commentaries again to get back and just go to games, talk to fans, watch games, talk about it on the radio, then jump on the train and go home. That's what I'd like to do again. It's not glamorous. Doesn't sound glamorous. It isn't glamorous, but it's what I know. It's what I love doing.
Yeah. All right. So I've really enjoyed speaking today. I'd love to have you on again in the future.
Yeah. So whenever you've got my details anyway, so you know how to get in touch with me. So not a problem.
Oh, brilliant.